All right, I'm going to read just as kind of introduction to Numbers before I ask for some prayer requests, so you can be thinking about those. I want to read from a little bit of Psalm 105 and Psalm 106, because the stories in the book of Numbers, they get brought up, and then they get brought up for different purposes. So here's Psalm 105, which is kind of a reflection on all the incredible things that God has done. It's very positive. You know, declare God's good works. Declare God's good works. And so Psalm 105 says, starting in verse 39, "He spread a cloud for a covering, fire to give light by night," they asked. "And he brought quail and gave them bread from heaven in abundance. He opened the rock, and water gushed out. It flowed through the desert like a river, for he remembered his holy promise and Abraham his servant. So he brought his people out with joy, his chosen ones singing, and he gave them the lands of the nations, and they took possession of the fruit of the people's toils, that they might keep his statutes and observe his laws. Praise Yahweh." Well, you may not, if you haven't read Numbers recently, you may not notice there's actually nothing from the book of Numbers in what is just said. It skips immediately from the end of Exodus and what God has done providing for the people and jumps right to him taking them into the land. Now, flip over the page to Psalm 106, because here's a lot more of what characterizes the book of Numbers. So Psalm 106, verse 24. "Then they," talking about the 12 spies that went in, "they despised the pleasant land, having no faith in his promise. They murmured in their tents and did not obey the voice of Yahweh. Therefore he raised his hand and swore to them that he would make them fall in the wilderness and would make their offspring fall among the nations, scattering them from among the lands. Then they yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor and ate sacrifices offered to the dead. They provoked Yahweh to anger with their deeds, and a plague broke out among them. Then Phinehas stood up and intervened, and the plague was stayed, and that was counted to him as righteousness from generation to generation forever. They angered him at the waters of Meribah, and it went ill with Moses on their account, for they made his spirit bitter, and he spoke rashly with his lips." So you get a picture there as the psalmist in Psalm 106 is meditating on just how kind of what kind of corruption has seeped into human, to even God's people. What is their character on their own really like? There, Numbers is brought out in a fairly large section. And I mean, that, as you read the book of Numbers, that's one of the biggest themes you come away with is the people's unbelief. And yet, God's incredible promise. So, we'll jump into that in a second. First, let's just take a second to pray. Are there anything specifically that we should be praying about? All right, open up to the book of Numbers. And there's a handout on the gray stand back there if you haven't gotten one. So let's just start with, you have there, first the geographical context. So the people of Israel, Numbers really picks up where Exodus left off. I mean, Leviticus is an expansion of what happened on Sinai, those laws, those regulations, those rules for what's to come in the tabernacle, the sacrifices, how people conduct themselves. I mean, Jeremy talked about, you know, clean and unclean and what kind of huge distinction that becomes in who the people of God are. Numbers picks back up with the story of preparing to leave. So the people have been at this wilderness mountain for over a year. They've been there over a year, just, you know, constantly getting instruction. But here's the deal. It's one thing to take the people out of Egypt. It's a whole nother thing to take Egypt out of the people. All right, so to take the people out of Egypt is one thing. To take Egypt out of the people, This becomes the training ground to see that. So the book of Numbers is a lot about geographical movement. They're starting at Sinai. They're beginning to move up toward the land. And you can see there on the map, they begin to move north into the wilderness of Kadesh. They're moving right to the edge where they camp right beside, the promised land. They send spies into the promised land. And of course, the spies completely are overwhelmed by seeing all of the people, inhabitants of the land. And they turn tail, they run, they bring back a report. It stirs up the people. The punishment God gives them is back to the wilderness for 40 years. This generation will not see the Lord. So they're back wandering then. And of course, eventually the end of Numbers brings us right back to the edge of the promised land. That way we can, when we walk into Deuteronomy in a couple of weeks, the people are standing, basically looking into the promised land, right? Moses dies on a hillside being able to see the promised land from a distance. So in one sense, you could follow this book just by geography, where the people go. Historically, we read there in Psalm 105, one of the prime ideas that is in Moses' mind and as well as the psalmist's mind is, how are the promises to Abraham actually going to work out? So you've got there kind of this handy little breakdown, people, place, presence, and blessing. And it's just a handy way, especially as we work through the book of Numbers, to keep asking those kinds of questions over. So God promised Abraham a people. Genesis 13, he was telling them, right, they'll be as numerous as a great nation, which was actually chapter 12. Chapter 13 was as many as the dust of the earth. By the time you're in chapter 15, you're as many as the stars of the sky. I mean, great, numerous people. Okay? Place. Right? He says, right in Genesis, first in 12, as he brings Abraham out of Ur and is bringing him this way. But in 13, all the land that I will give you, or all the land that you see, is what I will give to you. And then presence, right? After the wars where they go and they rescue Lot and he gathers the kings, he brings Lot back, Abraham's worried. And so chapter 15 starts out with that great line, I am your shield, and your reward will be very, very great. A reminder again that, and then of course as you watch the covenant ceremony kind of unfold, where the animals are split and they walk and God himself walks through, you get, if nothing else, the reminder that God is actually with Abraham to accomplish all of these things. And then finally, of course, chapter 12 told us that Abraham is going to be a blessing to all the nations of the earth, right? And Numbers is pushing that storyline forward. So, if we're gonna then sum up, okay, what does Numbers give us? Why don't these four things automatically come together as some of you have read the book of Numbers before? Describe what does the book of Numbers say is the reason these people don't end up in the land with all of these promises fulfilled? How does Numbers fill that out? If you're gonna say it in one word. Disobedience, I hear, right? Unbelief, sin, the people's constant just rebellion within their own hearts at regardless of whatever they're given to me. The obstacle to getting in the land was not whether or not God was going to give it to them. It's with what you watch unfold with the people. So you've got there a theme sentence that kind of helps, cover what the book of Numbers explains. Past promises will prevail in spite of present problems, which brings us back to Abraham. The promises to Abraham will be fulfilled in spite of all of the difficulties. And as you read the book of Numbers, it starts to get more than ridiculous as far as how the people respond to what God has done. So past promises will prevail in spite of present problems. So just as we stop and think, in that sense, we're the Christians in the exact same situation, right? We're given promises based on something that has happened in the past, the cross, right? The death and the resurrection of Christ. As we look back at its historical event, it's that event which then promises all of the things that we look forward to now, right? The people, those Israelites, struggled with the same kinds of things. And so I remember listening to one preacher was walking through. He had spent a lot of time with some missionaries, and I assume several of you have felt the same way at times. This missionary had struggled being so isolated for so long at feeling that God's presence was actually with him. Well, at one point, as they were getting some of their own missionary care, he had kind of learned, a psychological technique of taking a second, meditating on God's love for him. And he had a past where he had been abandoned as an orphan, and so the idea of God cradling him as an infant was comforting to him, right? And there is lots of things in the Bible that describes God as that kind of caring, nurturing parent. But if the preacher was just explaining at that point, if that is the primary, main, default place that a person's go to try to find the love of God, they're always basically choosing second best. Because for all of God's people, it's going back to the cross and the demonstration of God's love at the cross that is our primary, past-rooted explanation for why we have the love of God. So the Israelites face the same kinds of things, going back to past promises and realizing this is what God has done for us and living with the promises that come out of that. So back to Numbers. This is how we're going to kind of fly over it this morning. We're going to go chapters 1 through 10 and see God preparing to keep these promises. 11 through 16 are the beginning of a host of signs of unbelief by the people. So God punishing his people, him forming them, like Hebrews 12 talking about, these are his people, and he is forming them like a parent with a child into what you would hope would become an obedient people. As we see, they can't do that without a new heart. So it's God punishing his people. And then finally, in chapters 17 to 36, we see God's patience with his people. And perhaps, most importantly with that God's promises are actually going to be completed in spite of everything that's taken place. So, open to Numbers 1. And I want you to look there at verse 46. So, the book, it's called the Book of Numbers, which comes from the Greek Old Testament, is what it got named. In the Hebrew Bible, it's just called In the Wilderness, which is basically just the first three words in Hebrew. So sometimes you'll see it called, the Wilderness Book. So in chapter 1, in verse 46, as the census begins to be explained, we read, if I don't skip a page, there we go. All those listed were 603,550. That's also mentioned in chapter 2. So this is the men who were prepared for war. So if we're talking about promises to Abraham, we already have, if we have 600,000 men ready for fighting, we have a population of 2 million people. Just in terms of, 70 is what went down with Jacob to Egypt. And now we're sitting at, approximately 2 million people. This is not a small group that's trying to figure out how to travel through the desert. But God has kept that promise. So there's God's people. In these first 10 chapters, so much of it is the shape of everything being built. So in the midst of God's tabernacle, right, we have God's presence there. God will come down in a cloud or a fire to meet with Moses. at the tent of meeting. Once the tabernacle is constructed, the Levites are up and running, then God puts in place how all of the tribes are supposed to be organized around them. So you've got three tribes on every side, right? Making this kind of all-around encompassing, but God at the center of his people. All of this, so they're prepared. I mean, this if we're talking about God's presence, then we have, you know, the blessing of people, the blessing of his presence in and among them. All of this is so that they can be ready to pick up and travel and go into the land. Just over and over again. So as soon as he's done in the first couple chapters saying, okay, this is how you structure yourself, then it's, okay, now what are the different groups of Levites? How do we get all the Levites ready to be able to serve in the different places? You take down this part of the tabernacle. You take down this part of the tabernacle. All right, you're responsible for sacrifices. You're responsible for this. And so you see the organization of Israel helping structure them so they know how they're going to move from Sinai into the land. So it's all getting prepared for that specific place. However, in chapters 9 and 10, we get to God's presence. So flip over with me to chapter 9. And let's look at verses 14 through 17. So all this preparation has been done. And then the author stops and has them celebrate the Passover. So they celebrated the Passover, they left Egypt, and now they're celebrating another. And in verses 14 through 17, it starts with, and if a stranger sojourns among you and would keep the Passover of Yahweh according to the statute of the Passover and according to its rule, so shall he do. You have one statute, both for the sojourner and the native. Now, so he's finishing his instruction and then moves into, on the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and at evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until morning. So it was always, the cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. So this is now, things are lit up. All the preparation has led to people being ready to enjoy the presence of God, be in the presence of God, and we're ready to take off now. So, I mean, in some ways, I don't know how many of you felt this, but sometimes people often wish that this was more of the experience that we could have of the presence of God, this kind of close to. You know, people talk about God's Shekinah glory coming down, filling the tabernacle, how close the people are to the presence of God. And there can become a kind of wishful thinking of like, I wish I could see God be there like that. So this is just a reminder that the New Testament Christian, having the Spirit of God dwelling in them, is the experience that blows that away. For all that the people were supposedly close and seeing those kinds of things, the New Testament Christian actually has those things, has that presence of God with them, indwelling them, and then all of us as a people. So, you know, it's just a reminder as we even get ready for worship, okay, there's something far greater than what was happening back in the wilderness that happens when we gather and sing God's praise, and then as we go and just live our regular lives of faithfulness. So, are there any questions as far as then kind of that summary of the structure of Israel in those first 10 chapters? Or anything that you remember of other times that you've read as far as getting Israel ready to move into the land? Okay, let's move forward. This is where things start to get really bad really quick. So chapters 11. I want you to turn to chapter 13 so we can see. I want to read some of this account right here of what happens with the spies. So it's listed there on your handout, a few of the other hardships. As soon as they start to move, they're complaining about bread, about food, about Moses, even Miriam and Aaron, Moses' brother and sister, think Moses is getting too high and mighty. They themselves are powerful. So they're, you know, the people are complaining about them. But this, I mean, this is kind of the highlight as far as the people's rebellion. Chapter 13, verse 1, Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, "Send men to spy out the land in Canaan, for which I'm giving to the people of Israel." All right, so this is the promise of the place. "From each tribe of their fathers, send a man, send everyone a chief among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of Yahweh, all of the men who were heads of the people of Israel. And these were the names from the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, from the tribe of Zakur, from the tribe and tribe and tribe. Skip down to verse 17. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, "Go up into the Negev, go up to the hill country and see what the land is, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether there are few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, and whether the cities they dwell in the camp are camps or strongholds, and whether the land is rich, poor, whether there are trees in it or not. Be of good courage." So here's Moses' exhortation on the front end. "Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes." So they went up, spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin to Rahob, near Labo Hamath. They went up into the Negev, came to Hebron. Ahaman, and the names all listed, descendants of Anak, were there. Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And they came to the valley of Eshel and cut down there a branch with a single cluster of grapes. They carried it on a pole between them. Imagine this. One cluster needing to be carried on a pole. That place was called the Valley of Eshel because the cluster of the people of Israel cut down from there. Okay, now here's the report. At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land. They came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, "We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified, very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the hill country. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan." So right there, the people have given this report, heavily emphasizing the dangers that are in front of them. So it doesn't tell you there, but the people begin to feel the unrest of it. And so verse 30, Caleb has to try and quiet them down. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that saw in it, all the people we saw in it were of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." All right, so here's the report that the spies bring, and then they do the interpreting for the people. Okay, what you should take from our report is, and they fill it out, "We are like grasshoppers before them." And only Caleb has enough courage to say, okay, did anybody else walk through a sea? Not a year ago? I mean, did anybody else watch what God did to the Egyptians? And yet the people's fears clearly overtake them. So, and then we go into verse 14. So this is how the whole congregation responds. "All the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night, and all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is Yahweh bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to one another, let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. So you have a full attempt by the congregation to take over leadership from Moses. I mean, the people are stirred up at this point that there's nothing that's going to stop them. So it's essentially a mutiny. They want to return to slavery. Now, just as we stop, just trying to think of how you apply the book of Numbers, there are plenty of verses in the New Testament, right, that explain that one of the things that cannot be descriptive of a Christian is grumbling and complaining. I mean, Philippians, 2 just makes it clear, do not grumble and complain. Now, the book of Hebrews spells that out in a whole other kind of way of if this is what happened to the people, and therefore they didn't get to enter the land, the question on our side of things is, how much greater is the salvation that we've experienced in Christ that would root out this kind of grumbling, unbelief, discontentment with what God has for us? Right? So this story becomes the kind of image the author of the Hebrews is going to use, along with Psalm 95, to say, look at what the people are doing. They looked at good promises and good land. They knew everything that God had done for them and rejected it. Hebrews makes it really, really strong. Don't in any way act like these people did. Your promises are even greater than theirs were. Embrace them. So that's God's punishment for them is that entire generation will not get to enter the promised land. That entire generation dies in the wilderness. It's only their children who will get to see the land. And at that point, God is ready to do like he did at the end of Exodus, to just wipe them off the mat. What is Moses as the mediator going to do at that moment? So I just want to stop for a second and see, how does Moses intercede for them again? How does he act as the mediator? So chapter 14, go down to verse 10. All the congregation said to stone them with stones. So they're talking about Moses and the leaders. Stone them with stones. Here's where God intervenes first. The glory of Yahweh appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. So this puts the stop on their plans when they just saw the fire come down. A reminder, they're dealing with more than just Moses. Yahweh said to Moses, verse 11, how long will this people despise me? How long will they not believe in me? So there comes the root issue, their unbelief. In spite of all the signs that I have done among them, I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. All right. So his punishment to them is that the very thing that they wanted to do, avoid their inheritance, is the punishment that God gives to them. He disinherits them. And then says to Moses, instead, I will make a new people with just you. This is the same scenario that happened in Exodus. So what does Moses do? Verse 13, Moses says to Yahweh, then the Egyptians will hear of it. So just, I want you to listen as you pray. This is how Moses thinks in terms of, how do I intercede? What do I ground my prayer in? Then the Egyptians will hear of it, for you brought up this people in your might from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land, they have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people, for you, Yahweh, are seen face to face. Your cloud stands over them. You go before them in a pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. Now, if you kill this people as one man, then the nations who have heard your fame will say, it's because Yahweh was not able to bring this people into the land that he swore to give them, that he has killed them in the wilderness. So it is, he doesn't just rest on, okay, you know, but you've made a promise, or okay, but here's what you've said you've done. The fact is that Moses is concerned that all the other people that are in this land and around the globe will not be able to reverence and honor God's name if they watch the people wiped out under the same God who rescued them. He's admitting their deservance of all that they should get. But his appeal is, God, you're not going to be as famous if this is the route that you go. And now, please let the power of the Lord be as great as you have promised, saying, he's right. Now, this sign, this goes right back to Exodus 34 that we talked about a few weeks ago. Yahweh is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. Please pardon the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your steadfast love, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now. So this is what makes the book of Numbers so incredible, is that you begin to, it just highlights how patient really is God with his people. So he's patient with all of Abraham's screw-ups, keeping those. He's patient as the people immediately gather the land, begin to grumble. These people are even purposely rejecting over and over again all of the provisions that Yahweh is giving them. This is the story. This is our story of how slow, how patient God is, even with not just failings, but even our rebellion. I mean, and it just goes on. You know, 2 Peter comes in and says, the reason that the end of time hasn't come is God is patient. In Revelation, the martyrs are crying out over and over again. If God's going to come to anyone's aid, isn't it his people that have been, you know, slaughtered for his sake? And even then, he's holding them back, saying, wait, the time is coming where all of that will be taken care of. I mean, if just the general characterization you should have about God is how patient he is with sin and rebellion. It's incredible. The Bible just paints such a portrait of it, regardless of how the people act. So, what follows the results of all this discontentment? Moses has to intercede, and we're a long ways from the first 10 chapters of getting ready to go into the land. So, Moses pleads for the people. God actually just promises to continue to go with them, to be in their midst. So, with regard to the place, as far as going into the promised land, this has now been put on hold for 40 years because of this rebellion. The people are delayed. This generation is going to pass. It's only going to come to their children then. As far as God's presence, he promises in chapters 15 and 16 to continue to be in their midst. But what about being a blessing to the nations? Right? Moses' prayer in some ways is based on the fact that he's concerned that people become a blessing to the nations, that the nations might hear and not honor God's name as such. But at this point, with Numbers, we can't see, if they're not going to honor God at all, if they're going to be punished, if they're going to be kept out of the land, how on earth is God going to make them a blessing to the nations? So, at that point, we're left after chapter 16 with just complete, we're left with the people moving forward into the wilderness, but without any sort of plan. The people don't know any of what God is going to do with them. They're basically left in limbo. They're just going to follow because they don't have any other choice. So then we learn from chapter 17 on, this is how God's patience preserves his promise. 17, chapter 20, chapter 21 all are additional acts of disobedience. The biggest one being in chapter 20. Let's turn over to chapter 20 and verses 8. The people are grumbling again about not having water. And Moses is so either caught up in the moment or so frustrated again at the people that he himself actually falls into the people's rebellion. So Yahweh says to Moses, verse 8 of chapter 20, take the staff, assemble the congregation, you and Aaron and your brother, tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them, give drink to the congregation and their cattle. And Moses took the staff from before Yahweh as he commanded him. Then this is what Moses does. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels. Shall we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, struck the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their livestock drank. Okay, so you see right there, God's direct command was, this time you speak to the rock. Moses doesn't even just hit it. There's probably something in the fact that he hits the rock twice. Whether he hits it, he sees it doesn't come out, and then in his own personal rebellion, he hits it a second time. And God provides for the people. He still provides for them, even though Moses has done it this way. But this is what God then tells Moses in verse 12. Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me, there it is, the issue of belief, to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people as Israel. So how did Moses not treat Yahweh as holy by hitting the rock? Right? He was not completely devoted and consecrated to doing exactly what God says. He was not devoted enough. Whatever, he lost it in the moment. He's caught up in the people's rebellion. He's just frustrated because that's what they seem to be doing every time God does something miraculous. But the issue isn't just he disobeys. God gives us the words here. He didn't treat him as holy. And because of that, Moses doesn't get to enter the land. And then he calls, these are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with Yahweh, and through them he showed himself holy. Right? So here's the contrast. Moses didn't treat him as holy because he wasn't devoted to doing exactly as God said. Yahweh instead still shows himself as holy because he pours out water and provides for the people in spite of anything that they might do. So his holiness is seen in that he is keeping every promise that he has ever given to these people. And he's caring for them in spite of all of their rebellion. So, and then flip over one more chapter to chapter 21. And so this is the people setting out. This is the people after they rebel again. 21, verse 4, from Mount Hor they set out by way of the Red Sea to go around to the land of Edom. So now they're traveling in the wilderness. Here they discount God's words altogether. The people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no food. There's no water. We loathe this worthless food, this manna. Then Yahweh sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. The people came to Moses and they said, we've sinned. We've spoken against Yahweh, against you. Pray to Yahweh that he may take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed, and Yahweh said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten when he sees it shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent, set it on a pole, and if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. All right, so this is a strange account, primarily because, I mean, it's weird in all of its characteristics, but especially because It looks like they're putting up an idol of some kind. It looks like God is commanding them to put an idol up, look at it, and then receive benefits from it. Right? This is what he strictly outlawed in Exodus, in the Ten Commandments. And I think the way the story unfolds is slightly different from that. What God is actually having Moses do is put up a picture of the thing they're being judged by. So he's having him purposely put this picture of the serpent, these fiery serpents. Some translations just go with poisonous instead, that are biting and killing the people. Here's your picture of judgment. Put it up on a staff and look at this picture of judgment, and yet life is going to come out of it. And I think seeing it that way then helps us when we move over into the New Testament and Jesus is reading back on this story, right? And right before he says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life," right before that, he pulls this story out. Right? And he gives it as an illustration of what's going to happen to him. So from John 3, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should have eternal life." So this illustration that Jesus is pulling out is something similar is happening. Like that serpent, that symbol of judgment was up before the people and they were able to look and get life, so I am going to be lifted up. And the cross is exactly that. It's a symbol of judgment. But instead, of course, of a symbol of the people's judgment, Jesus is absorbing that on our behalf. So I think Jesus picking that up, that theme of there's out of judgment comes life, and using it to help explain this is what gaining life will look like. This is what must happen to the Son of Man. And it's so out of God's love that it happens that he sends his Son into that you might not perish, but have eternal life. So, God's patience, right? This is a picture of what's coming for us in Christ. So Lord's promises continue to prevail in the midst of the present problems. All right, now let's move down to this last section. So this is after, right, we're in this last section, but I want to jump especially to these, what happens to the people as they move. So they begin to travel in the wilderness. They begin to come back, kind of start slowly moving back toward the promised land. And Moab, the king of Balak, pulls in this famous Nostradamus kind of character named Balaam to come and bring curses on this people. So if you want to think about it, this guy is like the bad side of Merlin, but he's well known throughout the whole world. In the 1960s in Jordan, they found writings which describe Balaam being purchased by somebody else. So throughout the whole known world or whatever area he covered, Balaam is a prophet for hire. So there's some serious dark kind of evil that is associated with Balaam. And he comes and he's asked to prophesy, right? Every time he stands up to say something, he ends up flipping it and giving a blessing to the people of Israel instead. Right, the king of Balak keeps popping out cash. Here, go to this mountain, look over him. Go to this side, look over him. And every time he speaks, it's blessing instead. And eventually, Balaam actually begins to speak even more than what he knows. At one point, he says, there's going to actually come out of this people a scepter that's going to rule. And then, whether the narrator is showing what Balaam did or not, Balaam starts to pick up from the prophecies in Genesis. The things that were said about Judah and a lion. All of a sudden, Balaam starts talking about a lion and a lioness being the source of Israel's triumph. And so Balaam's prophecy is picking up on this and it's moving everything forward. These promises that were given to Israel are moved forward by this wicked prophet doing exactly what he can't, what he wanted to do. He couldn't curse the people. Instead, he blesses them. And so you see God's patience and is moving the story forward. But of course, as soon as you're done with that, instead of just having a curse put on the people, he tricks them to having, let's get the two tribes together, and all the beautiful women come down dressed, and they're able to entwine the Israelites into sinning with all sorts of sexual immorality with the people. And so judgment comes on them again. So here you have, by the time you get to the end of Numbers, these people who are constantly failing, constantly over and over, and yet God has brought them back to the edge of going into the promised land. The people are all set up, they're ready to go. And that's next week we'll cover, or next week Pylons and then a speaker from Surge, the mission organization, will be here. And then after that, we'll pick that up in Deuteronomy. What is Moses going to say and plead with these people as they head into the promised land? All right, let's get ready for singing and praising and listening to the word from there.